I'm Gwyneth Walker, and I'm a composer from Vermont, and I do indeed live on a dairy farm, which is why I'm wearing a cow pin to remind myself of my beloved home. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about composing, and we have a wonderful choir who will sing some of my works, and by the time we're finished with all that, I think you'll know pretty much what I do and about my music. As I explained earlier this morning, composing music and bringing new music to life, which is what we're talking about today, involves several different components, different groups. And the first would be the group that commissions the music. And sometimes that could be a chorus, an ensemble. Sometimes it's a community organization that's not even musical. It could be that a town wants to celebrate the centennial of the town, or the library, or a special event. Sometimes it's a piece in memory of somebody that the music's written for. So the very first step in bringing new music to life is that someone wants to commission a new work. The second step is me, a composer. You need to find the composer to write the work. The composer is not somebody who's necessarily always ready to drop everything else and write the new work. Sometimes it has to fit on a schedule. But for me, my background work is I needed to find myself a place to live where I felt I wanted to write music, where I was surrounded by supportive people and animals and views of the world. And it's not everywhere that a composer could live and feel inspired and ready to write. So my background work was training myself as a composer and then moving myself to a place where I wake up every morning and love what I see outside the window, and I have supportive neighbors for my work. So composers cannot necessarily write everywhere. Some people feel that moving to Paris or Manhattan or San Francisco or exotic places helps them be more creative. And for me, I really just like to see the open fields and those bovine faces looking at me. That just gets me going. So to be inspired as a composer, you need to live somewhere where you're not being stopped from writing. It's so easy to find reasons to stop creative people from doing their work. Harder to find the right place. So we have the first two components. Somebody wants to commission a work. They found a composer who has placed herself in an environment where she can create the work. Those each take some work. Now we need the group that will premiere the work. Sometimes that is the commissioning group, sometimes not. Let me see how to put this. I write for chorus or chamber orchestra or full orchestra or chamber ensembles, and always there is a group to premiere the work. And I always go for the dress rehearsal and the premiere so I can help bring this new music to life, listening very carefully, offering whatever comments I can say at the dress rehearsal that would be productive. It's not too great if the composer shows up at the dress rehearsal and says, oh, no, that's all wrong. And, you know, it's too late. So if things are not quite the way you want, you try to think of the few things you could say that might help it to be better at the premiere. And the premiere is not always the definitive performance, by the way. Sometimes you hear things in the piece that you realize could be better yet if you went home and did a little bit more work. Or sometimes the group that's premiering it is completely unfamiliar with the music because they just received it, and they're not going to be as good as a group that's then heard many performances and can sing it. So the premiere is not the definitive one, and it's always a little bit frightening when the composer sees the recording studio lining up for the premiere, you know, hoping maybe another performance will be better. So we get the commissioning group, the composer, the premiering ensemble. Then once the work is premiered and once I feel it's in good shape, I need to give it to my publisher. And we happen to have two of my publishers here. And without the publisher, my music wouldn't have gotten to those of you who have seen my music. Because most of you I do not know. I know these people, but I don't know everybody personally, and I have not sent my music in person to everyone. So I rely upon my publishers to get the music out to you. So that's step four. Most of my choral music is published by E.C. Shermer in Boston, and we have here Cynthia Schuneman from ECS. Do you want to stand up? There we go. And there are some white handouts from ECS, which we just made to list my current music. I have to keep updating. Some of my choral music is also with Treble Clef Press from Chapel Hill. And here's Mary Lichen. So you'll hear some samples of each repertoire. And usually when I go to hear a chorus that it's not the premiere, I've never seen that chorus before. I don't know anything about them, and oftentimes I arrive just in time for the concert. So this morning at 9 a.m., I had my typical experience of arriving with a group of people I never met before, a conductor, and there was no chance for me to say or do anything. What they were going to sing was hopefully what was on the page, and I'd have to just see how it went. So that was fine. I've had now the pleasure of hearing this wonderful chorus, so I can be extra relaxed because they're very good. We will start today with the piece, I Thank You, God. And somebody took the effort to put the words in your nice blue handout from Bel Canto, so I appreciate that. Although you can understand the words, for the diction is, the chorus is great anyway. I wrote this piece for the ACDA Honors Women's Choir at 1998. And there were 200 women from around the country, so that was obviously a big thrill for me. Jean Brooks had asked me to write this piece, and it asked that it be sacred or sacred in nature. And I had always liked that poem, I Thank You, God, for most this amazing day. And I had never set it to music, so this was waiting to be done, and I sent it to Jean, and he liked the poem. So I wrote it, and they premiered it. And I think I'll just say this one thing about the piano accompaniment, and then we'll hear the wonderful chorus sing. You know, the piano accompaniment is very important in choral works. Pianists do appreciate it if you give them a little something that's gratifying to play. And when the introduction starts in the piano, it is hoped that the spirit of the piece, the imagery of the poem, is set with the accompaniment, even before the singers start. So for this, I thank you, God, for most this amazing day. It's a very big statement. And therefore, I use the piano from the very lowest notes to spread over the keyboard to give you the sense of wonder of the poem. So that's how this is going to be. Shall we try I Thank You, God?
Thank you.
In case you're wondering, it's very gratifying to be a composer and to hear such a wonderful performance. You know, it's not another day at the office. It's for me, it's not that way at all. And in fact, creating music and bringing it to life and going to concerts is such an overwhelmingly emotional and personal experience that I would not attempt to do this every day. I prefer most of the time to be at home very quietly writing the music, and it's only on occasion that I come out to hear the music performed, because, you know, obviously one would overload with so many people and so much music and all the feelings, and I don't know how conductors do this day in and day out, but composers are often people who value solitude quite a bit, and I'm just like one of them. So in order to bring new music to life, I really need to be alone for long periods of time in the country. That's where I prefer to be. And when I'm peaceful by myself, then I can do my writing. I'm a kind of a work-a-day person, which I think other composers are too from the past. I didn't realize what a boring life a composer led when I was a student. I thought composers were much more bohemian and woke up in the middle of the night and wrote music. But in fact, most of us who do the writing for our lifestyle get up and work during the day as though it were going to an office. My office is my desk. And I write mostly at my desk. I use the piano for fooling around with chords, but mostly I write at my desk because you cannot approximate a chorus singing while you're trying to play it on the piano. There's just no way. The lines, the breathing, everything else. I figure if I can't sing a line, I really don't want someone else trying to sing the line. So I try to practice singing the different lines as I go along. But at any rate, my typical day would be that when I first wake up, I do a little bit of business correspondence because my mind is still a little half asleep there, and I take care of any contractual sort of business letters for a little while with email, which was so great for me. And then I stop all the business and I write for a certain period of time, hopefully about 4 hours in the middle of the day, 10 to 2. And I try just to write then, and I don't have telephone communications. Poor Sal was trying to reach me, so he almost begged by email, please, can I have your telephone number? And even so, then he didn't call me when he said he was going to, so what was the point? But usually I don't want interruptions when I'm writing. I'm sure you could understand that. Then I write until I have no more energy to write, and since I do it every day, 4 hours is about it. And then it's time to play tennis or do something that uses the body, some exercise, a few errands, and then evening doing more correspondence. So the business aspects are just as time-taking as the writing. And it's not as though I'm a self-published person or something like that. You think, business, what is she doing there? Because I have publishers, but the communications with the different people with whom I'm working are part of that. Another part of it is that I like to set to music good, new American poetry. And we just heard E.E. Cummings, 20th century poetry. And we're going to hear some poems by Mae Swenson put to music. And one thing it's important for me to do is to get permissions. I can't start setting these poems to music until the publisher has told me that I can. Otherwise, I'll write a nice piece, somebody will perform it, and then when it's time to give it to E.C. Shermer or Treble Clef, only to find out that I don't have permission to do that. Well, that's a huge waste of time. So it's good to get the permissions, and it can take a long time for those communications. So as soon as I find a poem I like, I write to get permissions, whether I have a project yet or not. It's just line them up. So that's part of the business. And I guess all the communications and traveling, going to other places, take up a lot of the time. So you think, well, that's kind of boring. Shouldn't she just be writing music? But the fact is, most composers and artists who make their living like this have to do some of the business, too. It's just, this is a business. And you have to earn your living by this. And also, you don't want to write pieces that just sit in your house. You have to get them into print. You have to get them into, you know, circulation to other people's hands. That's half the joy of it, is that when you write it, if it's any good, then you hope other people will get to play it. So my life is divided into my creative side and my business side. And I guess I'm able to somewhat sort those through. So I'll talk a little bit more about the business later, but I think I'd like to have the choir sing for you one of the Mae Swenson settings. It's in your blue book called I Will Be Earth. By the way, I found out about her poetry I read her obituary in the New York Times, and I do not read the New York Times obituary, so this must have been just a fluke. The paper fell open and there were these poems, and I thought, I'd love to meet this person. Well, of course, I couldn't, but I came into the city to her memorial service, and I didn't know her or anything, and I got to meet a lot of the people with her, and that was how I got the permissions, was actually going to the memorial service. So, you know, I really wish I had met her, but she was born in Logan, Utah, and I think her family were Mormons, and for herself, she found it was more creative to move to Greenwich Village, so she did, and that's where she wrote these poems. So, I Will Be Earth is part of my set for Songs for Women's Voices, six of them. And this one has imagery about a Scorpio in there, because that's the sign of passion. So we're talking about the astrological sign. And this song has some passion in the middle of it. All right. Let's try I Will Be Earth. Stay up, because we'll go right into the next one. That puts you in a mood, the Mae Swenson lyrical mood. So we'll just go right on, and I will say to you, love is a rain of diamonds in the mind, the fruit of the soul sliced in two, a dark spring loosed at the lips of light, under earth waters unlocked from their lurking, to sparkle in a crevice parted by the sun. A temple not of stone but cloud, beyond the roar of the heart and all violence. Blue permanence. Love is a rain of diamonds in the mind. Many things I would sort of like to say about writing music. I won't get to say all of them, but since the topic of this presentation is bringing new music to life, I thought I'd explain that it's a creative process, like bringing a child into the world, bringing life in, and that when you're writing music, it seems to me that you draw upon your musical training a good deal with the structure of the piece, and you understand what you want to do with the poem and the shape, and it's also logical. And then other things come in to the music that are purely just imaginative. I don't know how else to say it. Ideas pop into your mind that weren't taught to you at music school. They didn't have to be in that song at all. And they just go in there because creation of music is imagination too. And in that one, there's a lot of da-da-da, love is a rain of da-da-da-da-da-da-diamonds. And no textbook would ever tell you to do that. In fact, they would probably think that that would be silly to do that. But to me, it shows that the person who wrote this had a bit of fantasy and was playing with the word diamond. And so there's nothing that says you can't do that. So I do that. And when these little things creep out into the music that are not really textbook planned, but are more little quirks, I let them go in there, even though when I first read it, I think, well, we'll see. But when the chorus is singing that, it's good. It's sparkling like the diamonds, and yet I couldn't tell you where it came from. It just happened. And so when you're creating something, anything, whether it's music or something else, I think they're the two components. There's the trained, the intellectual component that structures the piece and thinks it's in charge, okay? But then there's the other side of you that says, oh, this could be nice. I think I'll try this, you know. And there's sometimes this little tug of war where this one says, no, no, you really shouldn't. And this one then says, oh, yes, I will. And then you come back and forth and you end up with a musical composition that we hope is logically structured that has a little bit of imagination in it. And if you're too much one way or the other, perhaps it doesn't always work. I mean, you can be very logical and write a completely logical piece that isn't imaginative and might not really capture people's interest. Or you can write one that's so imaginative that it has no structure and it meanders. To me, that's one of the worst things that music can do, is to meander, to just go on too long so that an idea that was nice initially loses its charm because it was overused or didn't take it to the right place. So I think in the way, you know, love is a rain of diamonds, or the fruit of the soul sliced in two, I think it's as though the fruit of the mind sliced in two also, and that you have to be able to allow the intuitive part of yourself to come out in the music, but you also need to have some shaping of the music, which we could call the intellectual, for lack of any other word, to put the piece together. And when I deal with a choral piece, as you probably saw, I don't go from the first word to the end and then it ends. That's not my idea of shaping a choral piece at all. My idea is to take words that are the central images and to use those as the focal points. And certainly I go in chronological order. I don't shift. I mean, E. Cummings has already done enough of that. I don't need to do that. So I don't switch the words ordering-wise. But I feel no reason to not bring back as a refrain. Like, I thank you, God. They say, I thank you, God, many, many more times than were in the poem. And it comes in between some of the other phrases. And I use that as a structural element. And one thing is, I do write orchestral and chamber music, where, of course, the structure is not at all related to words. And I think that it's probably healthy for me to continue to have some of the non-verbal parts of music in my repertoire, too, even if it's simply for the structuring aspect. So I do think about that. Even though I'm a fun-loving composer who lives in the country, don't think that I don't think about the musical shape and structure, because I do. And I studied that a lot, and I'm grateful for that. And I'm also reminded that when I was at the Hart School of Music, melody was very important. My teacher was Italian. And I guess I was very fortunate in the 1960s to study at a university which had fine faculty people who said, where's the melody? And he would say, where's the melody? And he had been a Puccini disciple. And so, where's the melody, you know? And there were a bunch of composition majors, each one more intelligent than the next. Bright guys would bring in complicated things, and Franchetti would say, where's the melody, you know? Where's the melody? And he was not terribly excited about having a female student for a student. He had other things that would have been great for the female students, but not as a student. But he was just so disgusted when these guys were not bringing in melodies that when I brought in a melody, he'd said, New England, you're in New England, what are you doing? And I would have a melody, and he just said, yay, a melody. And that really helped me to this day. And whenever I go back to Hartford and meet up with people from music school, I'm just reminded about melody, and perhaps the Italian part of the musical world does help with the melody in that regard. So I value melody a lot, and I think when you're writing choral music, you should be able to sing every part yourself in your own range. And if you can't, and if you can't find the pitch to come in on, how do you expect people who don't even know your style to be able to find the pitch to come in on? So hopefully one voice will voice lead to another, find the right pitch or the accompaniment or something. So those are some of the things. Another thing I learned, and are we getting geared up for our final production there? Okay. If you have personality, put it in your music. Because the more you put yourself in the music, the more it really communicates to other people. and the more you will enjoy writing music so that you will keep going your whole life. So I learned somehow, somewhere along the line, that I liked things that happened theatrically. And a sense of humor is not devoid from my personality. So I should put this into the music too, and I should just be myself in the music. If I live or, you know, if I succeed or fail, it will be by being Gwyneth Walker, not me trying to be Milton Babbitt or me trying to be Puccini, although I wouldn't mind trying. But I am not Puccini and I'm not Milton Babbitt. I'm Gwyneth Walker, and so it's best if I try to write my sort of music. One of the poets I like is Lucille Clifton. She's a character and a half. She's really great, African-American poet. She's alive today and has plenty of personality, and I love her poems. I've set many of them. And I did a set called Sisters. This is a set that Treble Clef handles. And this one here, Lucille wrote about herself and her sister, and they're at school, so you'll see some playground actions here. I won't say any more about that. I'll just say at the end, it says, where you sing, only where you sing, I poet. At the end, she ends this by saying, you are a singer, and I'm a poet. That's the only difference between her and her sister. So we'll now see and hear Sisters. Yes, I do think you have the hang of it. I do think they got the hang of it. Well, you know, if you can't have fun with your music, what's the point? And I do think that on every concert, it's good to have a variety of pieces. And I like I Thank You, God, and I Will Be Earth, and Love is a Rain of Diamonds. But if I had a whole program of those songs without this, then it really wouldn't be me. It would be missing some of my personality. So I like to put those things on there, but of course people at first are so used to programs being so lovely sometimes, so lovely. And getting those roaches in there, you know, that's a little bit risky. But I think when you get personality, Lucille's, and hopefully I've added some to it, that it really is fun. And when you are conducting a chorus and choosing a program, you do need to remember the audience is there. And the audience enjoys having something, many things, that speak to them on many levels in many different kinds of pieces. And you want people to come back, to have had a wonderful time at your concert. One of my joys in picking these new poems, Lucille Clifton, Mae Swenson, and even the E.E. Cummings, is that sometimes people across the country have not heard of these poets. And at the concerts where they've gone to hear, you know, sister, daughter in performance, they come away having met a new poet, too. And I don't find it, I don't feel at all, degraded to not be, if they walk out of the hall, oh, we love Mae Swenson, oh, we love E.E. Cummings, hi, you know, I'm the one who set the music. Well, they came away, they may have liked the music, too, but they had never heard of these poets. And I feel very pleased to be able to share some of that poetry, too. So that is a part of my daily work. It's not so much a part of my 4 hours of composing, but I'm always looking for new poetry. And when I travel, I go to bookstores, and I also bring in my carry-on bag my books of poetry to look at. And then, of course, I write for permissions right away. So that's just part of what I do. I could set, you know, Italian or Latin text or whatever, but my particular interest is in new American poetry, and so that's just something that I go with in particular. Mary, is there something I haven't said that I should say this time? She was there before. I don't like to really repeat myself, so I had never met this chorus before, you know, this morning, so I had no idea, and there was no way for me to do any coaching that would have been inappropriate. In fact, part of our session, I thought, might be that I would leap up and say, no, Jeffrey, change that, you know. But everything was so well done, and he added things of his own in terms of tempi, and sometimes he took things a little slower so that when I first heard it, I thought, oh, please speed it up. But then he did speed it up in another place, so it made sense. So I think part of being a composer is you have to be composed. You have to sit there, and you have to just wait it out because there might be a reason that he's going to slow down there, up there. I like people to take the music close to what I have on the page, yes. But I think if I just went and I wanted just that way and no other way, then I shouldn't be writing music for people to perform. I could write it for my computer to perform, and I could bring you a CD of my computer performing it. But that's not me. I like to write for real people and to hear real people perform the music. And real people are going to want to put some of themselves in there. I mean, they didn't have the fun of writing the piece, so they want to have their 2 cents anyway. So they're going to, with me sitting there, they're going to slow it down, they're going to speed it up, they're going to make little changes, just so I'm reminded that I'm not in charge anymore of my own composition. And this is what people do for that. Go ahead.
Actually, this morning, what you said sort of before that part was that as time has gone on, you have given more details.
Oh, yes. Yes. In order that I don't have the harrowing experience of going to the concert and having things at completely different tempos or dynamics than I wanted, I've learned to put much more in the score than ever before. I mean, not only the dynamics and the tempos and all the retards and everything else, but just adverbs or sentences almost of what I want. Smile here and do this. And for this Sisters one, I actually did write all the choreography in there because I thought if I just said to people, well, have some hand taps or whatever, that wouldn't be the same. So I worked it out, you know, and I had my music copyist put this all in, and he's very conventional music copyist. Who performs in a symphony orchestra. So when he had the hand taps, he said, tap hands. I mean, firstly, he didn't want to copy any of that. He said, really, you really want that? And I said, yes, yes, yes. And then he had cymbals. And then he said, tap hands and tap thighs. And he put right away, your own. Because he knew in the orchestra that if that had happened, the union would step in, you know, because people would be, and no. So, you know, he did that. It was so funny, you know, that you definitely should not tap anybody else's thighs during this performance of the piece. So I have put a lot more in there. And I was going to say, I have been writing music all my life. I started when I was 2, when I crawled to the piano and just started making up music and learned how to write it down by the time I was about 5. And this is what I have always done. And I'm 55 now, so that's 53 years of doing this. And I think one reason I still enjoy doing it so much is that I work with performers, and so there's so much coming in. You know, I write the music, but then I have so much coming in when I meet with the performers and go to performances. So it's a self-nourishing process. And basically, my parents just stood back and let me do this. They didn't try to tell me, no, you shouldn't, or, you know. So mostly along the line, people just stood back and let this sort of train come through. They didn't stop me. They didn't know what to make of me, and I was the only girl studying composition both at Brown and I think at the Hart School. And I'm sure the professors thought I was going to give this up. It was some hobby. But they didn't stop me. And then when they found out I actually really was writing music, then they just started really teaching me. And so I forgot about the whole, you know, spiel about all that barrier, because most composition departments, when the teachers find somebody who really can write and wants to write, they don't care what the person is, just so long as that person is their student writing. So that's been my experience, that the music itself just cuts through the other things. If you just keep writing, and if you have something to say, and if what you like to do, what you see in music and poetry, is also speaking to other people, then they pick it up. They pick up the ball and go with it. So I think we're almost finished here, but is there something else I should be covering? Yes?
Could you talk a little bit about the chamber music that you've done?
Well, this is, we're at the ACDA, so I'll talk with you later. No, I just mean that the ACDA has brought me here, and so this is, I'll be happy to talk about it. But it is helpful to also know how to write for instruments. And when you're writing for chorus, some of my recent works are for chorus and orchestra, or chorus and piano. Well, I have a choral piece with clarinet. We have the premiering clarinetist right here. So there, you got to learn how to write for those instruments. It's great, and also to keep in touch with what kind of concerts people actually do. And many community choruses or college choruses have concerts where they bring in a brass quintet. And then they ask me, do you have anything for chorus and brass? So I hear that so many times that, yes, I do. You know, I want to write in the areas where people regularly perform. I'm not going to write too often for chorus and 8 double basses. I mean, that might be a great sound, but I don't want to do that because I want to write the sort of thing where people say, oh, we're having our Christmas concert. Do you have something with brass? Yes, I do, because that's a viable genre, you know, or chamber orchestra. Or if you write for chorus and full orchestra, which I love to do, especially if it's community group and they all sort of pile on and have a great time, you have to be sure that the piece also works with piano reduction, because people say, we love to do it, but only once every 2 years do we have the full orchestra, and we'd like to sing it elsewhere. So those are some of the practical things, but I don't think that's very artistic stuff to know. It's just interesting to be able to see what other people program in general and hope that what you're doing can fit on the program but isn't exactly like it. I don't want to duplicate. I just want to be practical enough to write within the genres. Yes, sir.
How much do you try to listen to or avoid listening to what someone else has done? The I Thank You God text has been set many times.
Firstly, whenever I go to a concert where one of my works is on the program, I listen to everything else more than my own work, since I already know that. So I listen very carefully. I love to learn. I love to learn. But I don't go to concerts every night. That's too much. I tried it right. So actually, I have never heard any of the other settings of I Thank You God. So I think ignorance could be bliss there. It's better to not know. I know that some of the texts sometimes people ask me to set have been set before, but most of the time I haven't heard those. So that's probably just as well, because otherwise I would feel self-conscious. Yeah. Yes?
The business hat. You make a living composing.
Yes, sir.
Which means you get paid to do it.
Yes, sir.
You get a commission.
Yes.
But you also get per octavo.
I get my royalties part of the share, okay. Yes.
So as recording, people do recordings, they get paid very little on the amount of recording, 4 cents on, whoever knows what that is, but what's the margin on composing for paper?
Excuse me, what does that mean?
The margin? Profit margin. When you
profit margin.
How much do you get? How much does the publisher get?
Oh, well, I think I get, it ends up as 20%. It looks like 10%, but it has something to do with the hotel.
Is he talking about commissions, or is he talking about
He's talking about the sales. You should probably talk to Cynthia later. One does not make one's living off of the royalties of sales of printed music. What happens is when the music sells and gets out there, then people want to commission you, and you get 100% of the commission fee, and that's much more. So I wouldn't go around trying to make a living by the sale of the choral music, but the fact it does sell means that you all buy the music, and will know about me. And also, I'm asked to be composer in residence sometimes for a week at a place, and I'm paid for that. So it would be more the commissions and the residencies than the sale royalties. Okay. I don't know if I'd be happy to talk with you further about that later.
We buy octavos, we spend $1.50 per copy.
Yes,
so
I don't get that.
Small fortune for us.
I don't get that much of that one, you know. But the fact that E.C. Shermer gets so much music out there, that my goal is that you got the music at all and that you would know my name and perhaps commission the work or just keep buying it. I mean, it does accumulate. So, yes.
How much listening do you do to the commissioning person or commissioning group?
Often I never meet them at all.
They come to you and say, we want da-da-da-da-da-da. Do you pay much attention to that?
Oh, of course. I try to write what they want. But if they say, we have a high school chorus in Ellington, where are you? There he is. I'll be for Sal. We have a high school chorus in Ellington, and it's a good chamber high school. I write a piece that any good chamber high school group could do. I don't want to write one that only Sal's group can do. But his group definitely should have a piece that's written that sounds, that they will sound good singing. But it's, I think, okay, good small high school group. Actually, something that a good small high school group can do. A larger high school group or a community or college group. So he means a piece for his group. I think if I went over there and said, oh, they've got three strong tenors and one bass, and I want to write a piece with a great tenor part and one bass. All right, now I give it to the next chorus, and they say, we have three basses and one tenor. I mean, you know, you can't tailor it that much because, at least I wouldn't, because I'm sort of the, I work hand in hand with publisher. I would hope to write something that would really work with a lot of choruses. So I want to keep it practical and yet interesting and for his group. But if he's got a really odd configuration in his group, I wouldn't try to suit that. You know, one soprano, 12 altos, and whatever. I would just ask him to get a couple more sopranos for the premiere. And that, you know, what could I do? Yes. Hi, Charlie.
Yeah, what is a typical time frame from when you receive a commission to
Yeah, I'm not able to just drop everything else and write a new piece, but for an old friend like you, I would try.
I mean, is it months or half a year or a year?
Sometimes it can be a couple of years if the person doesn't need it right away. I would prefer to wait a couple of years. But sometimes things that come up that people who have been good to me really need something right away. And so I try to move things around. I try not to have it jam-packed. More is not better. So I'm trying to get to a position where I'm not locked into something. So, you know, I think growth is better. Artistic growth is better than more is better. So it could be 2 years. But sometimes if a longtime supporter needs something right away, that's why God invented the moving schedule, you know. That's all I can say. Yes? Okay. I write every day at a certain time, and by the time I finish writing, believe me, there are no more ideas for that day. And plus, the grocery store is not a place where I frequent. The walk. I think about the music all the time on the walk. Usually I can retain the idea until the next day when I'm writing. It's usually a structural thing. Actually, I walk through the whole piece on the walk, and if I'm writing a slow piece, sometimes neighbors say, are you all right, dear? Because I'll be going through the whole thing. Or, you know, yes. But I will test the validity of the structure of the piece on a walk.
Would that include the melody possibly
then? That already works. It's the structure that you need to support the melody.
So the melody doesn't happen on the walk?
No, the melody's already there. You know, that doesn't. That's. I don't have a problem with the melody. Thank goodness. Puccini's shown his favor upon me. Yes, sir.
When you sit down during your four-hour period to write, how directed are you in what you're going to do that day?
Yes, I work on a schedule, and I'm on a certain piece, and so I hope that day I can get through the development section of that little blah, blah, blah. or this, you know. I'm pretty well focused on a certain portion of the piece. I will have already planned the whole piece previous. I don't sit down day one at measure one and go to the meeting. I sit down for the first week and plan the whole entity. I work from the general to the specific. Then I say, I think I have the whole shape. I think maybe by next week I could write out this amount of it. And I really try to do that because I know I'll be traveling the next week. I got to finish this. I'm on a schedule for a specific spot. But this is a fallacy to think that you start at the beginning and go to the end. You better know what the whole thing is, or you're going to have quite an arduous trip from the beginning to the end, a bumpy ride. Yeah.
It sounds like you're fairly efficient when you write. Have you always been that way?
Probably. You have once got one personality, you know, embedded at birth. We're all different, so. I should probably let you all go, but I really so much appreciate the ACDA and the choral directors because you have made it possible for me to write for my living, not also juggling a teaching career, but to be able to write. And you all have been very supportive, so it's been my pleasure to be here. Thank you. Girls stand up again.